Good evening. I'm Mary Nichols, Dean of the College of Continuing Education, and it's such a pleasure to welcome you to this month's edition of Headliners. This unique monthly forum provides opportunities for us to meet with university experts as they share their firsthand knowledge of the medical breakthroughs, cultural trends, and foreign affairs in the headlines. Tonight, it's a particular pleasure to feature a distinguished member of the faculty whose scientific discovery recently made international news. Last August, three astronomers led by Professor Larry Rudnick announced that they had found the biggest hole ever discovered in the universe. In a paper accepted for publication in next month's issue of Astrophysical Journal, you can't wait till that hits your coffee table and kick your feet back and dig in. They reported their findings of an enormous hole in space, a billion light years across, which is hard to fathom, devoid of any stars, galaxies, or even mysterious dark matter. It didn't take long for this announcement to capture the attention of the mainstream media, and soon Larry was being interviewed about their discovery of nothing by USA Today, Time Magazine, National Public Radio, and the BBC. In my other life as a professor, I've done lots of research, and I often discovered nothing. Nobody was ever interested in nothing. Probably generally not surprised either, but at any rate. So ironically, Professor Rudnick teaches a freshman seminar on the concept of nothingness, titled appropriately, Nothing, right? But I think it's safe to assume that he never expected to become world-renowned for discovering a void so enormous that it challenges current models of the universe. Let me introduce you to Larry Rudnick. He's been on the astronomy faculty since 1979 and has been honored with the university's Distinguished Teaching Award, which is truly a fantastic award. In his research, he uses both ground and space-based telescopes to investigate large structures in the universe and the remnants of exploded stars. At the same time, he's actively engaged with a number of community educational organizations, including the Minneapolis Public Schools and Twin Cities Public Television, where he appeared as a frequent guest expert on the science program Newton's Apple. How wonderful was that? In 2005, he was recognized for these and many other outreach efforts with the university's Community Service Award. Currently, he is a founding board member of the Minnesota Planetarium Society, which is raising the funds needed to match legislative bonding money for a new Minnesota Planetarium and Space Discovery Center. You'll find information about this exciting project on your tables tonight. So will you please join me in welcoming Professor Larry Rudnick.
I'm always nervous when people clap before the talk. I'm not sure quite what the expectations are. There is no end to the wonderful... Oh, I have an hour and a half, right? Yeah, right? No. It's really hard. You get a professor and tell them they have 25 minutes, just like cruel and inhuman. At any rate, there's no end to the wonders that exist in the universe, and I'm going to talk about this big nothing with you tonight, and hopefully we'll get to explore in the conversation time lots of other different aspects of nothing. But in addition to big things, one of the biggest mysteries to me and what I enjoy as sort of hobby reading is things about brain science. And one of the most poignant times in the history of understanding language of the development of language and what it means to be human, one of the most sort of poignant times just happened this week with the passing of Washoe. And I don't know if you were just 2 days ago. Washoe is the chimp that learned 250 signs. And I don't know much about her. Other than she did this, and I find that, so I'm going to, that's what I'm going to do for recreational reading is go and try to understand a little bit of what we learned from Washoe. Well, this discovery obviously hit a very key nerve in people. I think probably it was a low news week, quiet news week, and we were a month after the bridge collapse in Minneapolis. But the idea that we just found a big hole was so accessible to everybody that it just took off sort of around the world. And so these are a few little snippets of some of the coverage. If you try to Google this, you will find stories about it in virtually every language that Google has, and including that one little cartoon there. I'm going to try to see if my arrow works here. Yeah, so I'll try to point with that when I need to, that I found on the web that somebody had done. Whoa, what was that? Okay. Ooh, I have a trigger there. Okay. It had done on the web and then gave me permission to use because it was just so fun. It was inspired by the discovery. And my Japanese colleague sent me the copy of the little article in Japanese at the top right and gave me the translation, so it says things that are okay, it seems like, because who knows what they would have put. Some of the coverage just was a little bit off base, but it's really been fun sort of to take this opportunity to be able to talk to people about what we discovered. So what we're going to do tonight in the beginning is I'm going to give you an introduction to what the discovery was, a little bit about how it was made, the significance of it, and then we'll just talk. And in order to understand this discovery, in order to make the discovery, we had to put together two different pictures. And those two different pictures are what we get from the very early universe and what we get from what I would call the more local universe. The early universe, the universe is 13.7 billion years old, a number that we know quite precisely, and about 300,000 to 400,000 years after the Big Bang, 13.7 billion years ago, is where we get light, the light from the hot Big Bang, the glowing radiation left over from the early universe, separated itself out after about 300,000 or 400,000 years and worked its way to us from that time, interacting very little along the way, passing almost freely, completely to us. And that's the early universe that we're going to talk about, and you have a picture of it in the bottom left. That is the leftover radiation from the Big Bang, 400,000 years after the Big Bang, 13.7 billion years ago. And then the other half of the story is what we would call the more local universe, and that is structure that developed starting at around 4 billion years after the Big Bang up until the present, 14 billion years after the Big Bang. So when we look out in space, we're also, of course, looking back in time because of the time it takes light to travel. So when we talk about the nearby things, we are seeing them as they were a few billion years ago. And when we talk about the early universe, look out and see the cosmic microwave background, we are seeing the universe as it was 14 billion years ago. And the discovery of the void involved putting together these two pictures. So a little bit of background information before we do it, things that we need to know in order to put together the pictures. This picture, you'll see the very distinct sort of circular pattern, these little arcs. Those are galaxies that normally would have appeared to be either circular or elliptical, and they have been stretched into these little arc-like shapes by the presence of matter that formed a gravitational lens and distorted the images into that pattern. And this is one of the key pieces of evidence for what we call dark matter, because when you look at the amount of matter that's in this photograph, it's not enough to distort the images. So something else is distorting the images. There is more gravity there than the light that we can actually see. And so this is one of the pictures that we use to provide evidence for dark matter. And dark matter is actually much more important. There is much more of it than the matter that we actually see. So there's about five times as much dark matter as there is normal matter, which is the stars, the planets, the galaxies, us. All of that is only one-fifth of the matter that exists in the universe. So that's one piece of background information. Another piece of background information came from studying very distant supernovae. And so you can see where the arrow is here, that there's a bright spot. Well, I'm not going to even try the mouse. There's a bright spot that is there in one photograph and not in the other. That's a star that exploded, a supernova explosion. And we use those supernova explosions as signposts to help us map the distances and map the time and the structure of the universe. And what we found, and this is now about 10 years ago, what we found by looking at those distant supernovae is that we've been missing 73% of the puzzle. That in addition to the dark matter, there's this mysterious thing called dark energy, about which we know almost nothing except that its effects. And now we are reduced. Everything that we knew about 15 years ago or so is only 4% of the known universe. All the stars, all the galaxies, all the gas between the galaxies, the planets, anything that you would name that you would have studied is only 4% of what's out there. The rest of it is dark matter at about five times that, about 24% of the universe, and then 70-some percent is the dark energy. And so we have, you know, we are just at the tip of the iceberg in trying to understand really how the universe works and what's out there. So these are in the background, again, of the discovery. So let's now go to the early universe and ask, what do we see of the early universe? This is a satellite that was used to the most recent one to study the early universe. It was originally called the Microwave Anisotropy Probe. One of the people that was instrumental in designing and building this was David Wilkinson, who developed cancer during the first year after the satellite was launched. He saw that the data coming in were good. It was going to work, but he never saw the picture that you're looking at now because he didn't live long enough to actually see the picture. And in his memory, they renamed the telescope the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe. And if you've ever seen things called WMAP, for example, in news releases and stuff, that's named for David Wilkinson. And it was especially meaningful for me to discover something related to this using the WMAP data because Dave was my thesis advisor at Princeton many years ago. And so it was very exciting for me to use the thing named after him as part of our discovery. So a few words about what this background radiation looks like. The early universe was extremely uniform. Virtually no fluctuations in it, almost perfectly uniform. And so what we have here is we're looking at a picture of the background radiation sort of as it really looks like. I mean, I've done it in PowerPoint, but this is the way the radiation actually looks. And that is extremely smooth everywhere. And out of that smoothness grew structures. They clumped up due to gravity. And it's a good thing they did because that's why we're here. We're here because of all the structures that exist, the stars, the galaxies, planets, and things like that. These are all clumped up structures. But the universe started out completely uniform. So I've got a line going across the bottom, which is just like a little cut to show you what the intensity is like as you go across the image. So as you go across the whole image, if I went across up here, and just plotted how bright is the radiation, that's what's plotted down at the bottom. And the average is about 2.73 Kelvin, and it is almost precisely 2.73 Kelvin everywhere you look. So the graph here goes up to sort of an arbitrary scale, 2,500. And now I'm going to zoom in and try to look in more detail to see what it's doing. So I zoom in by a factor of 10, and now the scale goes up to 250, and it still looks the same. You don't see any fluctuations yet. It's still smooth. And I'm going to zoom in again. So we're down to 25. And now there's a little bit of ripples that are showing. You can see a tiny bit on the bottom. And you may, if your eyes are good, be able to see that there's some fluctuations up at the top. Zoom in again. And now we can really see the ripples. But now we're down a factor of 1,000 or 10,000. I've forgotten how far we've gone. But now we can start to see the fluctuations. And finally, if I zoom in one more, then we get the image. So although you see the image with all these fluctuations from the early universe, they are really, really tiny, just a few parts in 100,000, and out of them, everything is going to grow. Okay. When people analyzed that picture and smoothed it out down to different scales to just study different properties of it, they found that there were a few special spots that seemed to stand out from the others. And the most special spot, which was called the cold spot, you can see the arrow pointing to the cold spot and then just a blow up of what that region looks like. And people studied that and were wondering what it was. Why was this the coldest spot in the space? And it started inventing ideas about strange things that would have happened in the early universe because everything else is so smooth and this cold spot sort of stuck out like a sore thumb. So the question is, what caused it? And there were various types of speculation going on about what might have caused the cold spot. And early in March this past year, we had a seminar. We had just a lunchtime talk, and one of the postdocs gave a talk about the cold spot and some of the thinking on it, and that was just sort of rattling around in the back of my head. Put that picture aside, and now we're going to talk about the local universe. So we talked about the early universe and the cosmic microwave background. Now I'm going to take you to the local universe, things that are just a few billion light years away. This is the top picture, gorgeous picture, done in the infrared, is what the filamentary structure of our universe actually looks like. So we have an infrared satellite. It goes out and it maps galaxies, looks at their distribution across the whole sky, and finds that they're all tied up in filamentary structures. It looks like sort of a three-dimensional spider web. That's what the sky looks like. And each of those little dots in that photograph is actually a galaxy, like that. So you just take each of those dots and consider it that it's actually just this amazing collection of 100 billion stars, every one of those little dots in there. But these galaxies themselves are organized into enormous strings and filaments and sheets, and their intersections where there's lots of mass we call clusters or superclusters of galaxies. Now, there's another picture that goes a bit further out, and that's the picture at the bottom, and that's the picture that we take with radio telescopes. And so at the bottom, you see a set of radio telescopes and the same kind of picture of the structure, but much further away. And we have trouble, in fact, finding the filamentary structure in it, basically because everything's far away and we can't distinguish things that are a little closer from a little further. So we believe that it's all filamentary, but here, the way that we've been able to do the observation so far, it's all just blended together. And each one of those dots in there is actually an extremely powerful radio galaxy, which, if my clicker will do, looks like that. And so in the center of those orange blobs is an optical galaxy, 100 billions of stars, and around it are these giant clouds of relativistic plasma, magnetic fields, electrons moving at relativistic speeds, giving off enormous radio radiation. And I've spent a good fraction of my career studying the physics of how these things work. So every one of those dots looks like this picture in the bottom right. But what we're studying now, or looking at now, is just the distribution of them. So they're interesting in their own right, but we want to look at how are they organized into structures. What kind of filamentary structures or clumping or clusters are they in? Because we're studying the large-scale structure of the universe, and that's what my students and I have been working on, actually were working on when we made this discovery. So what we did in order to look for the large-scale structures was say, we're not really interested in looking at all the individual dots. Let's just smooth them out. Just like people smoothed out the cosmic microwave background and found this cold spot, we wanted to smooth out this and look for large-scale structures. So one morning I was kind of frustrated and I just smoothed things out and found a dark spot. And the dark spot where you can see the arrow turns out to be in the same spot as the cold spot from the cosmic microwave background. Whoa, that's yes.
I'll have to ask a question. How does one smooth out?
Oh, it's just like Photoshop. It's the blur function. Make it blurry. It's exactly what I did. We have slightly more sophisticated software for the astronomical images, but it's exactly the same function. Blur out the details and just look at the overall pattern. So, you know, it's trying to see the forest where you're concentrated on the trees, but you want to see where things are clumped together, so you smear it out, you sort of squint your eyes, and just look for the overall distribution. And when I did that, then we found this spot. Now, I blanked out the stuff in the center, because that's where our Milky Way galaxy sort of gets in the way and confuses things. And nobody, when they're studying the distant universe, will work in that band, because there's too much confusion from our own very local galaxy. So outside of our galaxy, we had this dark spot where there were very few of those dots. Very few of those radio galaxies were found in this dark spot in the same location as the cold spot. And I could not figure out why those two things should be connected at all, because one of them was coming from the very early universe, 400,000 years after the Big Bang, and one of them, I knew, was coming from something that happened 10 billion years later. and why they should have a spot in the same direction was absolutely beyond me. And I sent an email, because we don't use the phone anymore, sent an email to my graduate student, because I don't go upstairs either. I sent an email to my grad student upstairs, and I said, Shay, please stop down, something interesting. So he's on his way to the bathroom. He stops by my office, and I said, come and look at this. I can't figure out why there should be a dark spot in the same direction as this cold spot from the early universe. And he says, oh, we studied that last year in cosmology. It's the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. And I said, what? So he patiently explains to me this effect that if you go through empty space under the influence of dark energy, and I'm not going to explain this to you, I'm just telling you what the result is. Under the influence of dark energy, which accelerates the universe, repulses gravity, overcomes gravity, and accelerates the universe, if you happen to be going through a cold a void, an empty area, and the universe accelerates at the same time, the photons going through, the radiation from the Big Bang, would get colder. And he spotted that immediately. He said, that's what's going on. And, oh, my gosh. And at that moment, and this is really what we live for in science, we were the only two people in the universe who knew that there was this giant hole. What we didn't know was how big it really was. And neither of us was comfortable enough to make the calculation, so we marched down the hall and got Lilia Williams, who studies structure in the universe, and she's the one that actually did the calculation and figured out that it had to be a billion light years across. And not only does it have to be empty of radio galaxies, which is what we found, and empty of stars and normal galaxies, the dark matter, even this other mysterious stuff, that's got to be missing too, because the effect is a gravitational effect, and we had to get rid of all the gravity inside of that hole in order to cool down the photons, in order to make the cold spot from the microwave background radiation. So these are the sort of side-by-side pictures of the two things that we were comparing. On the left is the early universe, which says there's a cold spot in this direction. On the right is our blurred out image of radio galaxies, where we're just looking at their distribution, and the blue essentially means there's very few of them there. That's the signature of the void. So it's early universe compared to local universe, and putting the two together, the way to connect them is because of this integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect that cools photons down when you go through nothing, which sounds impossible, but it really does work. And we can explore it a little bit more if you want to later. So this is pretty much where we are. This is the diagram that we had an artist draw up for us. We start out with the light from the early universe over here on the right, passing through the universe and passing through this giant void, a billion light years of pretty empty space. You could put little bits of stuff in. And after it moves through there and we get to look at it with our telescopes, there's the WMAP satellite. It sees a cold spot. And these telescopes, the radio telescopes that count the number of galaxies that we see in the web, it also counts a smaller number in that same direction. If you could see this with your eyes, which you can't, but if you could, it'd be southwest of Orion, in the constellation of Eridanus, the river that sits at Orion's foot. And so the cold spot is about 3 or 5 degrees across. By comparison, it's like this big, right? Okay. By comparison, the moon is a half degree across. So picture going about 6 to 10 moons in one direction, 6 to 10 moons in the other direction. So somewhere between 50 and 100 full moons. That's the size of this. It's big. It would be, if you could see it with your eyes, it would be a big patch of the universe. And so it's exciting if you go out at night and you spot Orion. You can look southwest of Orion into the constellation of Eridanus, and you can picture that out there is a billion light years, 6 billion trillion miles of empty space. And the thing that's striking about it, and the reason why it may cause us to reconsider things, is it's similar to if you were walking along the surface of the earth. And you go up hills and valleys, and every once in a while you encounter a mountain. And every once in a while you encounter a mountain that's really tall, 20,000, 25,000 feet. We have a few peaks like that in the world. It would be like walking along on the surface of the earth and all of a sudden coming across a mountain that was 100,000 feet high or 150,000 feet high. And you go, my gosh, where did this come from? Why is this thing here? Is there something different about the way that mountain was made, 100,000 feet high, compared to the 25,000 foot ones? And so that's the dilemma that we're in right now. The question is, do we need to revise our idea of how voids developed in the universe, these empty spaces? They're really natural, because if the universe started out uniform and then clumped up into stars and galaxies and clusters and superclusters, it had to leave empty space behind. So these voids are normal, and people have mapped them and they've studied them, and we know how many there are of various sizes and stuff. It's just that no one has ever found anything this big, and they've never looked out. I mean, actually, they've never looked out far enough to actually even see them. So we've got a bit of an unexplored universe out there, and this may be just the first of many more yet to be found. And if there really are many more, then we are going to have to change our idea of how matter clumped in the universe and how all the structure came to be, which is critical, again, for our own existence. How we got here is several stories in parallel. But one of those stories is the development of structure, because without the structure, we wouldn't be here. So it's one of our key stories, and it may or may not have to be revised. Now, it's a good thing that I'm actually giving this talk now, because it could be that another month or two from now, this whole thing will just disappear. which is a little ironic that nothing could turn to nothing. I don't even know what to... But we could be wrong in a variety of different ways. Now, no one has found anything wrong that we've done yet, but surely they are trying to take pot shots at it. And there is a paper that just got released this week. Yeah, so it was early this week, that was written before our paper was sent out. And basically they said it is completely implausible. They knew this integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. So they knew it was possible. And they said it is so implausible that there would be a void this large that here's another explanation. And they could be right. I think their explanation is less plausible than our explanation, but there are no simple explanations. They want defects in space. They want, well, whatever. So there could be an alternative explanation. It could be a statistical fluke. It could be that, you know, I did this smearing out, this blurring out, the counting of the galaxies. You can always get messed up by statistics, and so it could be. It could be that we didn't exactly do the physical calculation correct. Although it is the best of current knowledge, there are colleagues who have already written to us and say, well, you didn't take this into account, you didn't take this into account. The things that we've looked at so far, they would make some small changes in the size, but wouldn't change the overall conclusions. So nobody has really shot it down yet, but it could happen. And if history is any guide, it's got a good chance of happening. So it's a good thing I'm talking to you now, because there might not be anything there in the end. So a few words just to finish up, assuming that this will actually go to the next slide. There we go. I have been privileged in my career to be working on both sides of what is sort of one of the most exciting things I think that you can do, which is why I chose this career. And of course, you as taxpayers, you know, support me for doing this. So to think about these big questions, and it's a wonderful life to live. I've been involved in both discovering the stories and also in sharing the stories. And so I want to close with just a little bit of a pitch and tell you some aspects of that. One of the things that we're doing to increase our ability to discover the stories is the Department of Astronomy at the university is a partner in a new telescope, which is being built in Arizona, called the Large Binocular Telescope. The two telescopes there that you can see work together. Each of them is 8.4 meters, 25, 26 feet across, and they work in tandem to collect light and bring it together. It's a big project. We're always looking for support to help us support the operations. And so anybody that's interested in learning more about that, please talk to me. And then, as the dean mentioned earlier on, I've been involved with the Minnesota Planetarium. This is what we've been trying to build on top of the new Central Library in Minneapolis. We're currently before Hennepin County, the commissioners, because of the merger of the Hennepin County and Minneapolis systems, library systems. The project now belongs to Hennepin County. The commissioners have are still taking it under consideration whether to go ahead and grab the ball and run with it. So we're hopeful about that, but support is always needed, and we've got the brochures about the planetarium on the table. It's wonderful to be part of this adventure. And so I appreciate the ability to share it with you tonight, and I'm looking forward to the next hour of our conversation. Thank you. And we can talk about any aspect of nothing that you want.
The jokes go on and on. Larry, this is positively mind-bending, and I was just enthralled listening to you for half an hour. I don't understand it, but I followed it. I don't know about you guys. So let's open it up for questions.
I'd like to know if you were able to sleep that night.
I can fall asleep. It's not a problem. However, around 3 in the morning, I typically wake up. And the question is, what happens then? And at that point, no, I didn't fall back asleep. When things like this happen, no, the mind just keeps going.
Well, to say nothing of the fact that he's running for the bus at 5:50 in the morning, yeah. So at any rate, maybe he does get up at 3:30. Where's our next question here?
In the last slide you had in the figure over at the right, there were some other blue spots. Are they significant? Where the radio sources, are those other blue blobs significant?
Maybe. Yeah, we don't know yet. I guess that's really the answer. We don't know yet. What the next step has to be is we're going to be in January. We have time on this very large array of telescopes to do more detailed observations to try to eliminate the possibility that it was a statistical fluke. And so we will be getting many more counts to improve our statistics. And whether those other spots are significant or not, don't know yet. And so that's the first step. The next step will be to actually go out with an optical or an infrared telescope and measure the distances to the things that we can see and hopefully find that gap in distance as well. So we have a lot of work to do to follow up.
I've got two questions.
Good.
Does this void have the potential then to be from nothing to many things?
The question is, what will happen to the void over time? No, it's not going to fill in. It'll just stay a void. Due to the acceleration of the universe, it'll become less and less important because this dark energy is sort of smearing everything out a little bit. But basically, it's going to stay very similar to the way it is now. So it won't break up into many things. Is that the question?
Yeah. Yeah.
At least for the next few billion years. So next, we can sleep tonight, right?
Yeah, you've got at least a few billion years. But you had another question.
Okay. This counterpart to the cold spot that you call a dark spot, is that warm? Is that hot? Does it have a temperature?
You mean other places from the background radiation? Or which
dark spot.
The dark spot in the radio image?
Yeah.
That's not a temperature. That's just counting how many galaxies are in there. So when we do this blurring, so for example, if we could take the roof off all the buildings in the city, and including here, and you were to take a photograph, and then you were to just blur the photograph in Photoshop, you would see some blobs of emission where there were lots of people. So there's lots of people in this room. You'd see a bright spot there. And then you'd go out into the field, and there wouldn't be any people there, and you would just see a dark spot. And then you go to a residential neighborhood and see another bright spot. That's what we're doing here. We're just seeing how many things there are. So it's not a temperature. We're just sort of counting galaxies. That's all that this is representing.
Boy, we're understanding why you won a Distinguished Teaching Award here at the university, right? Tom.
Just quick, what's the difference between this and the idea of a black hole?
Yep. A black hole is something really physically different. There are lots of different things that we can't see, but that doesn't make them similar, except that they share that property that we can't see them. And so there are basically no similarities between this and a black hole, except that we can't see either of them. Well, there's lots of things that we can't see. A black hole, in particular, the reason we call something a black hole, when the force of gravity is so strong that light cannot escape from it. And that's what we call a black hole. So a black hole is something where you have very strong gravity and it traps light so that nothing can get out of it. And however, there is gravity and you can feel it. And the gravity due to a black hole will do things like warp the space around it. It will change things and it'll keep things in orbit. So a black hole can have lots of effects on its environment. There's lots of gravity there. We just can't see the light from it. This is just an empty space. And the reason we can't see anything there, why there's no or very few galaxies in that direction, is just because it's empty. So we can't see it because there's nothing there to see, as opposed to a black hole where there is something to see, but it's trapping the light so we can't see it.
You said, speaking of gravity, and you mentioned earlier about in the area of dark energy, as I understood, you were suggesting that gravity had no impact, or at least dark energy overcame gravity.
Yes.
And of course, here you're speaking of in a dark hole, there is gravity.
Yes.
And so yeah, I'm a little confused
this.
In terms of...
Who's in charge?
Yeah, right. Yeah. What's going on here? Okay. Right.
And that depends on the scale that you're looking at. So, for example, the sun has a mass that is about a million times the mass of the Earth, maybe 100,000 million times the mass of the Earth. And yet, the moon goes around the Earth, even though the sun has much more mass than the moon. And that's due to the proximity. Because the moon is so close to the Earth that the gravitational field of the Earth keeps it trapped and in orbit around the Earth. And so when we talk about a black hole, in its little local space, it's the king or queen. It's the thing that dominates that area. And so light around that region or anything that's in orbit around that region, it's going to be dominated by the black hole. However, when we look over very large areas, we have to re-ask the question, who's in charge? And in order to do that, we have to sort of add up everything that's there. And when we add up all the mass that's there in a large area, and don't look at the details around each little spot, but add up over the large area, and we calculate all the gravity. And when we look over that large area and we calculate all the dark energy wins. And what would happen if the universe was dominated by gravity, which it used to be? Dark energy actually came off fairly recently. Dark energy started becoming important about a billion years ago, recently in astronomical standards. When gravity was in charge, the universe was expanding, but it was slowing down because gravity kept trying to pull everything in and stop the expansion. And so early in the universe, it started expanding and then it started slowing down. And the observations, the new observations came in, said that the universe has started speeding up again. And that was the takeover of dark energy. So if you look in some tiny little place, the moon still goes around us. We still go around the sun because we're nearby the objects where gravity is dominant. But when we look at the overall distribution, dark energy wins.
Is there something happening between the empty space and where there is stuff? Is there a skin around the empty space or something at that interface?
Yeah, I don't think that our current understanding is that there really is no interface. There's no like surface there. There's no surface tension. Actually, that's not, of course, there's never a simple answer to anything. Yeah, that's not quite true. For the stars and galaxies, there's no interface, but there is gas in those filaments as well. And that's what my students and I were actually looking for when we discovered this. was the gas and stuff. And so there may be interesting things going on there with magnetic fields and gas and things like that, but that's right on the edge of what we know. So we really just don't, we're really just not sure yet. And that's something we're still trying to study.
I think that you said that if more of these voids were discovered, that that would have some implications for our concept of how the universe formed. Would you care to expand on that?
No, because I said as much as I know. Look, we didn't even want to do the calculation of how big this thing was. We went down and got my colleague. I definitely don't want to take that one. No, I just, no. And probably not the formation of the universe, but the evolution of the universe after its formation, the development of structure. And so my level of understanding really is to simply say there's a problem there, but I really don't even know where one would go with that problem. So, sorry.
Two questions. One is, in that top picture, what's the real big black space on the left? And then the second question is, you talked about photons going into the dark space and cooling down so much they lose their light. Do they come out on the other side, gain energy, and light up again?
Yeah, I will actually try to explain this effect for you, and we'll see whether we can do it. Does anybody want to speculate on why there's that giant hole down in the bottom? The big black area. It's too far south. You build the telescopes, and you can't see that far south. So it's just the area that wasn't observed from the Very Large Array, which is at a latitude of 35 degrees in New Mexico, and they couldn't see down, after you get down to the horizon, you can't see any further down. So that's all it is. And so I was down in Australia for the first time in December, never having been south of the equator before. It's really sad to see a professional astronomer try to figure out the night sky. we don't grow up, most of us, as amateur astronomers, who are the ones that really know the night sky. Some fraction of us do, but I grew up in physics and went into astrophysics, and I know about three constellations pretty well, and I definitely didn't know any in the south. And so I saw Orion upside down, so that was fun. That I recognized. But then I knew there were things I wanted to look for, but didn't know where they were, and I had forgotten to bring star charts with me, so I was really hopeless. Grad student and I were on the roof of the hotel. We're looking up. We can't figure out what we're looking at. We ran down to the lobby, had to buy a card to use the computer in the lobby, and the printer didn't work, so we couldn't print out the star chart. So here's the two of us, professional astronomers, staring at the screen and going, okay, if we see the three stars that look like that going from Orion, and then we rushed back up to the roof, we were able to see the Southern Cross. It was great. Okay. Anyway. Where are we going? Oh, so that was the big hole. That's just the place that the telescopes couldn't see. The second question, so let me actually try to do an explanation of why do the photons cool off? Why do they lose their energy? You can think about it like this. Let me explain the opposite first. I'll explain the opposite. Suppose you have a hole in the ground and you're rolling a ball and it comes to the hole. Now, as you roll the ball towards the hole, then as it starts falling down into the hole, it picks up energy. It starts moving faster. So it picks up what we would say kinetic energy. So it's rolling into the hole, it picks up kinetic energy. And if there's no friction involved, then it'll just roll right back out and lose all that kinetic energy again and just roll out the other side of the hole with exactly what it went in with. So the ball rolls in, speeds up, slows down coming up, and then ends up this no change by the time it comes out. I'm ignoring any kind of friction. Same thing would happen with a photon. Particle of light would come in if there's a big gravity well, a cluster of galaxies, a supercluster of galaxies sitting there. As it moves into this cluster of galaxies, the photon will gain energy. So it would get hotter. It would gain energy. And then as it comes out, it'll lose the energy again. Ends up exactly the same as it started with. We okay so far? Okay. So now we're going to throw in dark energy. And what dark energy is going to do is it's going to stretch out that hole while the photon is in there. Photon comes in. falls down the hole, gains energy, now has to climb out, but the hole is not as deep as it was because dark energy stretched it out. So dark energy stretches it out. It loses energy coming up, but it doesn't have to do all that work because the hole is shallower. It comes out with a net boost. So it gained a lot of energy going in, gave up a little bit of energy coming out, and ends up with a net boost. So when you go through concentrations of matter, clusters and superclusters, and then you have dark energy that stretches things out, you end up with a boost. The opposite thing happens when you go through a hole. When you go through a hole, you end up with a little loss. Because it's just like going, it's the opposite effect. It's like going over a hill, and the hill gets stretched out. So where was the question? Okay, did I do that?
So when it comes out, it's going to be less bright than
it. Yes, less energy. Each photon will have less energy, and we will see it as a cold spot because we will interpret the number of photons reaching us as a temperature. And so if there's fewer, or they have if they have less energy, then we would measure it as being slightly colder. And it's a tiny, tiny effect. I mean, remember, go back to the beginning of what I was doing with the slides. All this stuff is tiny, tiny perturbations on top of what is otherwise an extremely uniform background.
Yes, just as you're explaining how the universe is expanding at an accelerating rate, do you speculate that this hole is also growing? And I guess related to that is, what is the universe expanding into? Is there this enormous void? That's just a little part of the void?
Okay. I would say that it's expanding into nothing, but that would be a cheap shot, and so I won't. I won't say that. Yes, the whole, everything, on those scales. See, here's the interesting thing. The universe is expanding, and not only is it expanding, it is accelerating in its expansion. It's getting faster with time. However, there are a bunch of objects which have already, I was talking about this proximity effect, there are already a bunch of objects that have separated themselves out from the expansion. So they become lots of little points that are just riding along in space, and they are getting further apart as part of the expansion. But if you look in detail inside them, they're not being stretched. So our bodies are not expanding, nor is the solar system expanding, nor are clusters of galaxies expanding. However, when you get to the larger scales, then the structures do start to expand, and now I've forgotten so that was the first part of the question. So yes, that hole is expanding, but the structures that have bound up, the things that are close to each other, are not taking part of that expansion. It's just the distance between them which is separating. The second part of your question, if the whole universe is expanding and accelerating, what is it expanding into? And it's hard to answer that question. The theory that we use to describe the overall structure of the universe is based on Einstein's general theory of relativity. Einstein's general theory of relativity does not allow a solution in which the universe is in one place and emptiness surrounds it. That's just not a solution of the equations. It's not one of the allowable solutions. So if Einstein's general theory of relativity is correct, and so far it's passed all its tests and still looks quite good, then the universe that you are trying to picture, which is a very normal thing for us as humans living in a finite universe to try to picture the edge, is not a solution to Einstein's equations. So that's one comment. The second comment is, suppose there were an edge to the universe. We look around and we see this microwave background radiation that is uniform to parts in 100,000 or so. And so what that would mean, if the universe has an edge, is you better put us right in the center of that to within a few parts in 100,000. Because if we were closer to one edge, we would see a difference in one direction of the sky than in another direction of the sky. And we don't see that difference. So from the theoretical standpoint, applying general relativity, we would say we can't allow an edge. Observationally, we don't worry about the theorists anyway. We go out and make observations. Observationally, we would say there's no evidence for an edge. because the alternative would be to say we're living right in the very center in a very special place, which we reject as a on philosophical grounds. So what can you picture? So now I'm going to try to answer your question. Having rejected your wonderful suggestion, I'm now going to try to offer you an alternative. So here's an alternative. We'll just go into two dimensions. Picture a sheet of paper, graph paper. So it's got the lines on it going, you know, crisscross. You've got a grid of lines, sheet of paper. And I'll let that extend out to infinity in that direction, just infinitely far out in that direction, infinitely far out in that direction, infinitely far out in that direction. The sheet extends forever. But we can look at the little grid marks on it. We can see the little squares on the sheet. As the universe expands, the little grid marks get bigger. Each one of those little boxes gets bigger. But where's it going into? Well, it's not. It was infinite before. It's infinite still, except that each little box is bigger. And if you understand that, you're better than I am. But but that's the way I try to picture it.
You mentioned that the universe, initially the Big Bang, it expanded and then it slowed down.
Yes.
And is that the reason we're able to detect the background radiation of the Big Bang? That it initially expanded faster than the speed of the radiation, then it slowed down so that the original radiation caught up?
No, we would see it, you know, we didn't need it to slow down because the background radiation is traveling at the speed of light. And the expansion is not, but if you press me on that, then I'll have to take it back. But in general, we have this odd time in the universe where the expansion effectively was faster than the speed of light, but I don't really want to talk about that at all. But no, we didn't need it. Because it was traveling at the speed of light, we didn't need it to slow down in order for the light to catch up. The light would have caught up with us anyway.
There's a question in the center here.
Yes. Have you developed any speculation as to the shape of the nothingness and whether there are more like that out there that you've picked up so far?
Yeah. It's an interesting philosophical question. What is the shape of nothing? Does nothing have a shape? But this issue really is not philosophical because it's an empty spot in space, and what do we know about its shape? We have a little bit of information on its shape because we see the size of it in the sky. And we make a calculation that says, if we accept that that is the empty spot as seen in the sky, how deep would it have to be in order to create this cold spot in the microwave radiation? And the answer is, it would have to be about as deep as it is wide. So in good physicist form, we call it a sphere. But it can't be very far from the sphere. It could be elongated, maybe a factor of 2 or something like that. It could be slightly elongated, but it can't be a very long, thin tube, or it can't be a very flattened disk that we're just seeing the front of. So its dimensions are all comparable in each of the different directions. For the voids that we do see in the universe, there are odd shapes, but they're not extremely long and thin. And in fact, if we go back, you can even see them yourself. You can't see them in three dimensions here, but you can see them. If you look at that top picture and you just concentrate on, try to pick out, if you can, one color at a time, you can sort of see the empty areas between that color. And they're just sort of odd-shaped type empty areas. So they're not really spherical, but they're not very long, thin tubes or very sort of flat structures. So odd shapes of comparable dimensions in all directions.
I guess we're thinking along the same lines. That was my question also. But I was also wondering, since it is marginally spheroid or whatever, does that give you any ideas to its origins or at least its evolution or its environment?
Not yet. It would be... First of all, we have a problem with its size because it's so much bigger than everything else. If the shape were different than everything else that we saw, then we would have yet another problem, and that would really be a clue. If the answer to your question was, oh, it must be long and thin, yes, that would have been an important clue. But the fact that it is roughly spherical in shape or similar dimension in all directions means that it probably grew just like the other things did by being left behind when material clumped on its boundaries, except that it just left too big an area, too big a volume.
Hi. You mentioned pre-early universe as being uniform.
Mm-hmm.
Disregarding religious theories, obviously, what are the scientific theories regarding like how the uniform started clumping? What enacted upon that? What do you know, I guess?
Sure. Well, our current ideas on that are that there are those of you that have studied or read about quantum mechanics know that nothing can be perfectly steady, that there are always fluctuations. And if you take a particle and you try to put it in a certain spot, there are always going to be some uncertainties, some fluctuations in its position, in how fast it's moving, in its energy. That theory, which describes these fluctuations, is extremely well developed. It is what is responsible, for example, for radioactive decay. It's responsible for the structure of atoms. So that's a very well-developed theory in both physics and chemistry, this idea of quantum fluctuations. The current thinking is that those little fluctuations in the very early universe came from quantum fluctuations. And one of the actually exquisite pieces of information that has come out in recent years from this mapping of the cosmic microwave background is that if you start out with these fluctuations in the very early universe and then predict what should the pattern look like on the sky as we see it from 400,000 years later, I didn't bring any of the diagrams with me, but we have basically beautiful predictions from that theory that match up the structure that's seen in the sky. And so I think the answer is reasonably solved at this point, that it is quantum fluctuations that do it.
Okay. Can you go back one slide, please, that previous slide you had? I look upon that graph or that picture as like a, let's see.
That one?
The one with the dark spot and the yellow contours there. Now, I look upon that as being like a contour plot, and I think of it in terms of densities, mm-hmm. and therefore the blue is less dense than the green, mm-hmm. which is less dense than the yellow, etc. If that's less dense, how do we know it's actually zero? I mean, there's nothing there. Why isn't it not just less dense, and there are things there, but fewer?
Right. We don't know that it's really empty. What we know, if our ideas about this are correct, what we know is there's a certain amount of gravitational potential, mass, dark matter, matter, missing. Because that's what we need to do in order to create the cold spot in the microwave background. We have to pull out a certain amount of matter, a certain amount of gravity. So what we said was, suppose that you completely emptied out a volume a billion light years across, would that do the job? And the answer is yes. Now, if you want to say, well, suppose there's some matter in it, then we'll go fine, then we're going to have to build something that's even bigger than a billion light years, because we still have to get rid of a certain amount of mass. So yes, there could be some stuff in it, but then we would just have to expand our calculation to carve out that we need a certain amount of mass to be missing in order to create the effect.
Let's go on the far side of the room there.
I'm not quite sure I can even put this into a question, but it's just really a foggy idea. I'm a social scientist, so I'm from the other end of the world.
My condolences,
it's quite all right. I understand. All right. Yeah. But if I understand correctly, would it be of any help to be able to, as you describe a photon going through the void, right, and that it, your analogy of the ball rolling through and coming out energy, right? If our picture of that thing right there is as a photon going through a very big piece of nothing, does your discovery give us any explanation of what's happening in terms of expansion and contraction of our universe? In other words, if what is outside of that egg-shaped
right.
thing is in fact just another big piece of nothing that some other scientist discovered.
Well, our effect, it does tell us something about the expansion of the universe, because our effect is predicated on the fact that the universe is accelerating. If the universe were not accelerating, we would not see the effect. So it doesn't tell us much more about other structures and stuff, but the fact that we see the effect, the physical interpretation of it is based on the fact that the universe is accelerating due to dark energy. So in a sense, this is a confirmation of that. It's a little bit circular, but it is a confirmation that the universe is being driven by dark energy in recent times. And that's sort of the best that we can do. It doesn't tell us more about the surroundings or anything.
So let's go back here to the back.
You indicated that you said maybe this wasn't discovered by somebody else because they hadn't looked out far enough.
Mm-hmm.
Does that imply that if you could look out further, you could potentially see the formation of it, or if you could look in closer, you could see the change of it? Does that?
We wish we could do that, but we're trapped. You see it at a time which is regulated by its distance. So this void is somewhere at a distance of 6 to 10 billion years, light years away. So let's just call it 8. So it's 8 billion light years away. We're seeing it as it was 8 billion years ago. We don't get to see it the way it was 6 billion years ago or today. In order to do that, we'd have to wait. So that's one of our dilemmas. We can look back in time, but we're looking at different objects also. It'd be lovely to be able to study the same object through time, and that's almost like the light catching up question, but we'd have to go faster than the speed of light to catch up to see it at different times. So we're stuck. But the question you're asking is exactly what astronomers do. They do it statistically because even though we can't study a single object over time, we can study the ensemble of objects as a function of time. And so, obviously, one of the definite follow-ups, assuming that this holds up, is that we are going to have to look at these large distances, 8 billion light years away, and see what else is out there. And then figure out, if we don't see them nearby, then is that a time effect or is it a space effect? A lot of stuff to be sorted out.
You were talking about the evolution and as things congregated due to a quantum effect type of thing. What's the chance that this was a sort of fluke, a Maxwell's demon, you know, shunting everything off from it?
Absolutely. It could be. So I said it could have been a statistical fluke in terms of our counting, in which case there's no significance at all to our discovery. It's just an accident. But it could be that the whole discovery is real, but it has no significance because it's just an accident. So it's like seeing a bunch of little clouds and one giant one and looking for some special reason of why is that one giant, and there may be no reason. It may be just an accident of 10 clouds happen to come together, but there was no special reason for it. So, yes, it could be that there is nothing to be learned from this, that it is just an anomaly. It happens to be one very big one and just an anomaly. Yes, that's possible. And I'm sure that's part of what people will be considering. Is it reasonable to get that type of anomaly? Because that's a statistical question. You know, how big of an anomaly are you willing to accept before you really start worrying about it? And when you ask questions about things like, are we alone in the universe, those questions come back full force, right? We've got one example of intelligent life, and, you know, is it just a fluke or is it something natural? So when we try to do that kind of thing, we're right on the horns of that dilemma.
What particles make up dark energy or theorized particles? Nothing?
That's why we call it dark energy, because we're clueless. Same thing with dark matter. We know that dark matter exerts a gravitational force, so we call it matter because it exerts gravity. But we have no idea what it is. There are a bunch of suggestions, and there are experiments here at the university that are going on trying to find it, find evidence for the particles that make up dark matter. But we don't know what they are, and we really don't know what dark energy is. And if I tell you, you won't believe me. Well, I'll tell you anyway. We think it's the energy of the vacuum. That's one of the best ideas now. It's the energy of the vacuum. And just to, let me give you an example, which is, it may be not our everyday experience, but something that I'll just point out. You know that, if you convert water from the liquid form into the vapor form, you do that by pumping in energy. So you pump energy into water and you can turn it into a vapor. That's what happens with our sweat. That's the way we cool off, is we steal heat from our body to evaporate the liquid which is on the surface of our skin, and it goes into the vapor state and takes away the energy. You need energy to do it. By the same token, if you were to look at, just take a chunk of atmosphere, a lot of water vapor in it, just in the air, there's water vapor all the time. You might say that, yes, there's air in this box, and there's water vapor in this box, but other than the normal things of temperature and stuff, there's no extra energy in there. I mean, I know about the air, and it may be moving a little bit, but there's no hidden source of energy. And then all of a sudden, we do the reverse process, and we get the water vapor to condense. And if the water vapor condenses, it's actually going to give off a bunch of energy, because it's the opposite of what we just said. In order to make vapor, you have to put in energy. And so if you're going to go from the vapor state to the liquid state, you're going to release a lot of energy. And it's called the heat of condensation? Is that the term? Something like that.
He's asking us.
Yeah. Whatever. Okay. You're going to release a lot of energy. So we would call that a phase change, a change in phase of the water that went from just being a vapor in the air to condensing into droplets, and all of a sudden energy is released. And actually, it's a very important source of motions in our atmosphere, because it's partly responsible for what develops thunderclouds and stuff like that, is there's enormous transfer of energy when droplets form. So it's a change of phase that releases an enormous amount of energy. We think something similar actually happens in the vacuum. That the vacuum of physicists is not an empty place. It may be the place from which you remove everything you can, but there is no such thing as an empty place to a physicist, partly because of these quantum fluctuations. Things are constantly going in and out of existence, fluctuations going on in what we would normally consider empty space. And this vacuum has various states associated with it, and the dark energy may come out of a phase change in the vacuum. Like changing from water vapor to water liquid, the vacuum itself can change states, and in doing so, release some energy. And that's one of the ideas, and I told you weren't going to like it, but there it is.
Let's go to the middle of the room here. Go ahead.
Is the temperature of this nothingness absolute zero or very close? And if it is, what happens to the radiation passing through such an environment?
Well, the radiation passing through it gets colder. That's what we're seeing. That's the effect that we're seeing. The radiation that passes through it gets colder. It itself has no temperature. In order to have a temperature, you've got to have energy or matter or something whose temperature you can measure. So there really is not a temperature associated with the empty space. There's radiation passing through it, just like everywhere else, but there's not a temperature of that space itself.
Does finding a feature of this size tell you anything about the limits to the size of the universe?
No. I haven't thought about that. It's a good question. I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think that we've gained any new insights into that. You've been pretty easy on me so far. No deep philosophical questions or questions about nothing.
Oh, we're just getting warmed up.
Okay.
Is there a question over there? Other questions here?
Uh-oh, when people I know ask questions, I know.
It's not going to be that hard. One of the ways you discovered this was because of its proximity or its location in the same place as the cold spot. Is that cold spot the only cold spot we're aware of in the universe?
It's the one that sticks out like a sore thumb. There are others that are a little bit cold that don't stick out quite as far, so we've started with this one. And if it pans out, we'll go after the next ones down in line.
Hi, I'm just trying to understand this concept of the energy of the vacuum.
Oh, I shouldn't have done that.
So if I understood you, you're saying that there could be particles there that might decay into daughter particles and give some energy off in the reaction. Is that sort of what you were saying? Anywhere close?
You're pushing the limits of my knowledge, let alone the knowledge of the field, let alone my knowledge of it. Thinking about it as particles, yeah, we sometimes express it in particle language, but it's best off, I think, to think about it as an energy state. So it's an energy state of the vacuum, and there is more than one possible energy state. And it, just to give you an analogy, which doesn't really help explain it, but it gives you something to picture. It'd be like going into a valley and thinking you were at the bottom, and then moving over a little bit and finding, oh my gosh, there's another hole off to the side that I never even saw. And so what we currently think of as the vacuum, and say, well, that's the lowest we can get. We know that there are other possible states that it may be possible to just get even lower. And that's sort of the best I can do.
In the center here.
Early on you mentioned the structure of the universe containing filament-like things. Is that related in any way, do you think, to these string theories that talk about the very basic building blocks of matter, I guess, as filament-like vibrating structures?
Strings seem to be dying. It's an interesting idea. People have tried to connect high energy string theory with these, or even build cosmic strings and stuff. That's sort of not gone anywhere. I mean, it's very interesting when you think about sort of how does science work on the frontier. You can't just explain what you see. You make an observation. You try to explain it, and that may get people excited for a short while, but the only scientific theories that are going to survive are those that ones that take you to the next place. And so string theory has not taken us to the next place, and there are still people who are promoting it and hoping to get it to the next place, but it's been around for 20 or 30 years now, and it's not gotten us new insights. And so it's really sort of falling out of favor. It doesn't mean it's wrong, but it is a story about the way science works, that if you don't have an idea which is rich and give you new insights, then people are going to let it go. And that's where string theory is right now. So the current thinking would be, no, these structures that you see, they have to do with hydrodynamics, for example, and they have to do with how gravity interacts with matter and things like that, but strings are probably playing, the current thinking would be strings are playing little or no role.
Say, Larry, could you give us social scientists and a few artists in the room just a thumbnail understanding, sketch understanding of string theory?
No. Oh, God. No, I don't even want to go there.
Don't want to go there.
No. You'll invite somebody. Oh.
Are there some other social scientists in the room? Yeah, and artists? All right.
Okay.
A question in the back here.
I have two questions. The first one is this dark energy. You said it was relatively new, like a billion years old.
Yes.
What are the current theories that what has caused it to become like what are the theories regarding its birth, I guess?
Yeah, why is it developing now? Mm-hmm. Within the last billion years or so? And people don't know. They're making up answers for it. They're talking about the fact that the whole universe was like rolling down a hill until it reached a point that the dark energy became important. But it's all just black magic at this point. We really don't know. People have different ideas, but it's at the stage where not only do we not have a theory which is predicting things for the future, we don't have a good explanation even of why it would be important now. So there's a few different ideas on the table. Nobody's standing solidly behind. Even the proponents of them are not thrilled with them, because they're just making them up, basically, to match the observations that we see. The amazing thing, well, one of the amazing parts of this story, though, was that one of the possibilities for dark energy was something that came out of Einstein's equations. So for those of you that have done some calculus, for example, when you do an integral, there's an extra constant that comes out. If you do an indefinite, if you're not following, don't worry, I'll come back to you in a minute. You do an integral, and there's an extra constant which you can either put in or not put in. When Einstein originally solved his equations, he realized he had the possibility of sticking in an extra constant. At the time he did that, we didn't know the universe was expanding. And he knew that that was a problem, because gravity, under gravity, you either could have an expansion and things slowing down, or you could have things collapsing. But he thought the universe was standing still, and there's no way that the universe could be standing still. So he said, okay, I'm going to use that constant. And it was called the cosmological constant. And it was put in there to repel gravity so that the universe could be standing still. The observation was wrong, because that was before we knew the universe was expanding. And then after we knew the universe was expanding, you didn't need the constant anymore. And so Einstein called it the biggest blunder of his life. And he died thinking it was the biggest blunder of his life. And we've now reinvoked it, because within the last billion years, but only within the last 10 years that we've discovered it, we found we actually needed his constant to get the universe to expand. So it may be something that just comes out of the general theory of relativity, but we don't know yet. And if that made any sense at all, but it's
amazing. We have a question back here.
Yes, this is probably a terribly naive question, but I'll give it a shot anyway.
Go for it.
If you accept that we are experiencing significant climactic changes in our world, would you care to theorize on what impact this might have on our universe or even beyond?
Well, there's no question that we are experiencing severe climactic change on the Earth. I don't think there's basically no connection. What happens on the Earth will have no effect, basically, on even any other planets in our solar system. So if you look at sort of the sphere of our influence, what we're doing to the Earth, it may be horrible for us, may be horrible for life on the planet, but the sphere of influence of that is tiny. It's really just the Earth itself. The moon, even the moon, which is just 1.25 light seconds away, couldn't care at all, will have no effect, no matter what we do to the Earth. So, they are different places in which we need to put our attention, but they really are decoupled. The opposite, of course, is not true, or hasn't been true historically. We are intimately connected with what went on in the early universe. The fact that we're here today is the product of not only the structure formation, but the formation of the elements that made the Earth and make up our bodies, which all happened in the stars. And so we are very intimately connected with the history of the universe. But having done that, we're now decoupled. The universe really doesn't care about us. Having made us and let us go, we're sort of free to do what we want on here, and we're not going to affect the universe.
I took it as a bit of a challenge when you said a few minutes ago that we have been easy on you. not asking any philosophical questions. Do you mind if I ask you a deeply spiritual question?
Do you mind if I don't answer?
No.
Please.
I do not mind.
No. Go ahead. Please ask.
As many of us have, we have struggled with reconciling the concept of our God with science.
Sure.
And I assume you have also in your life. Would you care to comment in any way about that?
Yeah, let me comment on that within certain boundaries. Scientists are all over the place on spiritual questions. However, most scientists are really quite clear that there is a sphere in which scientific questions can be asked and answered and explored, which is influenced by and may influence, but really is separate from religious questions. And so religion can serve certainly as a form of inspiration for scientific questions, give us interesting questions to think about, and that certainly does, you know, for me. But the questions of sort of how did the Earth come to be is a question that historically religion had an answer to. And my feeling is religion would be both foolish and cheapened to try to answer that question today, because our science has gotten sophisticated enough that we actually know the answers to those questions. And so if you take what I consider the essentials of religion, which is the question of the existence of some all-pervasive entity, which may be called by different names, the question of purpose in the universe, the question of why we were here, these are fundamental questions that science is probably never going to have anything to say about. But if you want to take that religion and talk about the physical things that we can study as scientists, religion's going to lose in the end. It may not lose in the popular mind, which is why we have all the debates about what should be taught in the schools, but it is going to lose because science, as it gets more and more sophisticated, answers those detailed questions. It's not going to ask why. It's not going to answer why. It's not going to answer why does the universe even exist? Why did it come into being? Sure, we can understand how it works, but is there a reason why it came into being, or is that just, again, a complete accident? For any of you that are interested in it, the best book that I've read on this, it's a wonderful book. It's deep. It's hard. But it really explores these questions deeply, is by Paul Davies, D-A-V-I-E-S, called The Mind of God. And he's a distinguished physicist, cosmologist, and he explores these questions. And it's a wonderful, book. So I think that, there is, you know, when I teach the elementary course, Introduction to Astronomy, I don't mention religion at all. It's just not part of the course. I don't mention it at all. And then at the end of the semester, I ask the students to write me an essay on how did their view of the world change as a result of the class. They learned an enormous amount of stuff. I know what they learned or what they didn't learn because I have the final exam and I can see what did they get or what didn't they get. But I ask them the question, how did your view of the world change? A third of them write about religion. And I didn't talk about religion at all. And there's not even a single direction that they go. There are some students who say, I don't need a religion anymore. You know, my parents are going to be very disappointed, but I don't need religion anymore because you scientists have got it all under control. I thought religion was there to answer questions, and you scientists have taken care of it. Don't need it anymore. And then there's other students who say, I cannot believe how wonderful a creation the universe is and how it deepens their spiritual feelings so much to see how well All this stuff meshes together. And especially when you ask about the conditions that allow for our existence, how sort of marvelous it is that we're even able to be here, given all the things that had to happen in order for us to be here. And so I think this is a deeply personal thing. You've got to bring your own spirituality to this, let it inform your spirituality, but it doesn't take you necessarily one direction or another.
Oh, what a wonderful invitation for all of us to think more about that.
I just have one question. I don't know if I read this or whether I saw it on public TV, but I understand that Einstein, when he was working on a particularly difficult equation, would sometimes comment, "I wonder what the old one would think about this."
Oh.
And I just wonder, do you ever comment, "You wonder what the old one would think about this"?
No. I think I'd get in trouble for that. But no, it's not. Einstein did a lot of that, but he didn't believe in God. Although you will find lots of quotes by him about God. When he was interviewed on the subject, it was a way for him to phrase, he believed that the universe was orderly. And, you know, my personal beliefs are, there is something beyond what it is that we directly study. There are connections that we have in time and space and to the universe that I can't really understand and I don't expect to understand as a scientist. That was Einstein's sense. Einstein's sense was, there was some harmony in the universe. There was some order. And one of the most powerful ways to talk about it was to personalize it and talk about the old man or God. And in one of the famous debates that he was in, he was arguing with somebody about quantum mechanics, which he didn't like, and he was wrong. But he said, "God doesn't play dice." That was his response. God would not have created a universe in which you just take these random fluctuations and have them go. But when asked about those kind of quotes, he didn't really believe in a separate entity that you would call God. He believed in sort of the universe. He had a very spiritual sense about the universe and its order and the way it all worked. But the God language really was just a way of grappling and describing that.
Oh, since we discussed some other theories, such as string theory, I wonder if you'd care to speculate on the alternate universes hypothesis.
The question is this the only universe that exists? And we don't know. That was an idea that maybe 15 years ago would just have been dismissed as not necessarily silly, but not part of science. See, there are all kinds of questions that you can ask that a scientist would say, "I cannot picture any way of answering that question." And then we don't call it science anymore. So if you were to ask the question, "Why are we here?" and I can't think of any experiment, even whether we could do it or not do it, or any theory that I'm going to be able to use to answer the question, "Why are we here?" then I'm going to say that's not a science question. And so this question about alternate universes was put outside the scope of science. That it was interesting speculation, science fiction or whatever, but it wasn't anything that we could know anything about, and therefore it wasn't a real science question. It may be a good question, but not a science question because there was nothing we could do about it. That's not true anymore. There is constant speculation about parallel universes, alternate universes. A couple of years ago, Scientific American did this whole exploration of parallel universes. I think it was their special issue a few years ago in September about parallel universes and multiple dimensions and universes that may exist separately in time and space. There's all kinds of interesting speculation going on now, and we're not quite at the point, but close to the point that the thinking about that could influence our current theories. So you can see the possibilities of connection. And that's why it's serious science now, because there may actually be some overlap with our understanding of what happened in the very early universe. So right now, it's still on the fringe. It's not well connected with mainstream science, but there's lots of interesting thinking going on in those directions. And given what's happened to me as I've gotten older, I think I live in an alternate universe. And thank you all. Okay.